Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Radio Renaissance. I'm your host, Jared Taylor, with American Renaissance. And today is July 9th, Anno Domini 2024. And with me is my indispensable co-host, Paul Kersey. And we will start with comments from our listeners. One writes in to say, every day or two now brings a new case of illegal aliens murdering or raping American adults or children. And we shouldn't be surprised. Import the third world, become the third world. Since Joe Biden took office and announced to the entire world that he would no longer deport illegal aliens, nor even attempt to stop them when they showed up, we've had about 20 million illegals. We know this is being done because the vast majority of those people are going to be voters for the Democrat Party. Only whites vote as a majority Republican. This is being done to make sure the Dems have a permanent lock on power. So the left knows full well that flooding America with millions of third worlders means that thousands of Americans will be murdered, thousands will be raped, many more thousands will be victims of violent crime. They know this and they don't care. If that's what it takes for them to gain a permanent majority, thousands of victims are acceptable losses. Now, this is a not uncommon point of view, and it may be a point of view shared by many of our listeners, but I just don't think our opponents are as brutal and as really just singularly power mad to the point of not caring about Americans being killed. They don't like Americans being killed, and of course, they do want the Democrats to remain in power. But I think at the same time, there's this moral urge to do good, to be anti-racist. And I don't think it helps constantly to be demonizing our opponents. I think they have nothing but scurrilous motives in mind, that they don't care about thousands of Americans dying or being raped. I think they do care. They don't want that. They really don't want that. So I think it is not useful to paint our enemies as black as night, because nobody is ever entirely black. I think there are very few people who are 100% out and out evil. In any case, you are free to comment on my observation or not, as you choose, Mr. Kersey.
I'll pass on commenting. I'm just going to say hello to everyone out there and welcome. I hope everyone had a great 4th of July and really excited to once again speak to our amazing, captivating audience as things are, you know, there's a lot of positive stuff out there, and we really appreciate all of your comments. And we can't do this without you guys, our great listeners. So indeed. I won't comment on it, but I will just say again, I think it's a welcome once again to have the opportunity to speak with you and speak to our audience.
True. It is always welcome. Another comment. This has to do with the fact that last week I hesitated to quote Mao Zedong when I paraphrased his observation that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. I didn't want to give the guy too much credit, a guy who did so many things wrong. But a listener writes in to reassure me. He says, Mao was merely repeating the famous proverb of the ancient Chinese sage, Lao Tzu. He says, you will find the original in the Tao Te Ching, chapter 64, line 9. Well, well, well. So I should have simply quoted Lao Tzu rather than Mao Zedong. I was unwittingly quoting the founder of Taoism rather than a man who was responsible for perhaps more horror than just about anyone in the entire 20th century. I'm somewhat relieved and I am grateful to our erudite listener. Another comment. A few episodes ago, you mentioned that a Swedish gangster rapper named C. Gambino had been shot to death. You also said this rapper is white, and you wondered what it is about the profession of rapper that gets even white people snuffed out. Correction. His real name was Karar Ali Salem Ramadan, and he was about as European as camels and shish kebab. So, once again, a valuable correction from a listener who knows more about something than we do, Mr. Kersey. I really appreciate this kind of listener comment. Well, to me, having lived in France for a while and having paid attention to French politics for many years now, the French elections have been on my mind. And certainly everyone living in France knows, the second round of elections ended on Sunday. That was after President Emmanuel Macron had called a snap election because of the huge national rally gains in the European parliamentary elections sometime before. Now, the National Rally is the somewhat identitarian party. It's been weakening its identitarian quality for some time because Marine Le Pen wants power more than she wants ideological purity. In any case, Macron had decided that the French public had voted wrong, so he's going to give them another chance to vote. He called this snap election, but he realized that after the first round, the National Rally was coming in first. And as we've discussed before, Mr. Kersey, when you have a two-round election system the way the French do, and if no one gets an absolute majority, say you get a field of candidates, maybe four or five candidates, nobody gets 50% plus one. So you go into second round, and what you do is you have the top two finishers, and if anybody had gotten at least 12.5% of the registered voters in the circumscription, then they will also participate. But so mostly you will get maybe three finishers. And what the entire political establishment did in France in order to keep the National Rally from getting an absolute majority, and as it turned out, even from getting a majority at all of the votes, what they did was if the lefty candidate was doing better than the righty candidate, say if there were three candidates, one was National Rally and one was sort of soft conservative, like sort of our Republican Party, and the other was lefty, could be hard lefty, doesn't matter. If whoever was ahead of those two, the remaining one would drop out. So if the hard lefty was not doing as well as the they would be the Macronist kind of semi-Republican types, then the hard lefty would drop out. So there were only two candidates left. And it would work the other way around if the hard lefty was ahead. So this was a kind of a political alliance, a ganging up against the National Rally to make sure that it did not come in. Did not come in first. Well, whatever the case, there were some 30,000 riot police waiting, including 5,000 in and around Paris to ensure that the radical right and the radical left do not take advantage of the situation, says Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin. Well, and here are the results. There are 577 seats in the French Chamber of Deputies, as it's called. You have to have 289 to have a majority, and you have to have a majority to form a government. Well, turnout was very high. And as I said, the left wing and the centrist candidates all urged their supporters to defend what they call democratic values and the rule of law and not vote for the National Rally. This is just so absurd, as if Marine Le Pen and the people who want France to remain French are opposed to democratic values and the rule of law. In any case, there was an unprecedented number of these gang up on the National Rally situations, no fewer than 216 out of 577 seats. There are 216 seats in which the National Rally had a real chance of winning, and the lesser of the two opposing candidates drops out so as not to split the vote, so that National Rally had to go head-to-head against just one candidate rather than three candidates, rather than two other candidates. And as a consequence, the National Rally did not do nearly as well as would have happened if they had not had this electoral alliance against it. And it does appear that when the second round came around, people were not as willing to vote for the National Rally. So what happened is, this lefty alliance, it's called the New Popular Front. It's practically every species of leftist under the sun, from raving Antifa, hard-boiled communists, let's just start over from the beginning types, all the way up to sort of moderate social democrat types. They came in first. They got 26% of the vote opposed to, they got 182 seats in the Chamber of Deputies, as opposed to the National Rally, which got 143. So the lefties came in first. Now, they, because of this electoral maneuvering, they got their 182 seats with only 7 million votes, whereas the National Rally got its 143 seats with it had to have 10 million votes. This is one of the peculiarities of the French system. It's a little bit like the Electoral College in a way, but the National Rally, because of these triangular alliances against them, had to get more votes per seat than the guys who came in first. In any case, after the first round victory, it seemed possible that the National Rally could get an absolute majority, in which case their top guy, a guy named Jordan Bardella, I think he's only 28 years old, a very sharp, nice-looking, extremely articulate, extremely popular, and first-rate candidate, he would have been prime minister. Well, as it turns out, after the first round of voting, when it looked like the National Rally was going to do very well, what did the lefties do? They rioted. Now, when this left alliance won, what did they do? They rioted. That's mm-hmm. just what lefties do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this leftist alliance, it's the guy who's most important in it is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is he is an out-and-out communist. As I've said before in this podcast, we have people who claim to be Marxists. In Europe, certainly in France, they have, sure enough, people who are Marxists, not just Marxists, but communists, people who are explicit that if they think violence is required to establish the dictatorship of the proletariat, then let there be violence. These are really nasty, hard-boiled people. So the fact is, though, even by coming in first with 182 seats, that is far from the 289 seats to have a majority. So France, I'm talking about this leftist alliance. So France is in a real quandary. In ordinary European electoral politics, what you would have is a coalition government. You would have a little horse trading. You'd have a minister from this party, a minister from that party. The prime minister would be the guy who was from the largest number of votes, in which case that would be this leftist alliance. There'd be some horse trading, and you'd finally work out some sort of coalition government. The French politics is very hardball in France. And even the people who are in this leftist alliance, they are people who hate each other's guts. And so it's very, very going to be very, very tough to get any kind of coalition government, any government of any kind. So this last-ditch alliance of the lefties, is it going to be possible for them out of only 182 seats? Remember, they need 289 to have a majority to actually come up with a government. It's going to be an absolute circus for the next several weeks, maybe a month. So in any case, one of our listeners, who is a very astute observer of what's going on in the French elections, he wrote this. He said, the effete, wealthy, cosmopolitan liberals who support Emmanuel Macron, that is the centrist group, they were driven to enter into an electoral alliance, not only with the Socialist Party. Now, this is what I was talking about, these voter alliances. And I was referring to Emmanuel Macron's group as sort of the soft, squishy Republicans in the United States. So we had these three groups, the National Rally, who wants France to remain French, this lefty coalition that goes from all the way from social democrat socialists all the way to just Antifa bomb thrower types. And you have Emmanuel Macron's centrists in the middle. And so these wealthy cosmopolitan liberals who support Emmanuel Macron were driven to enter into an electoral alliance, not only with the Socialist Party, which is committed to democratic legality in theory and in practice, and the rump of the Communist Party that theoretically still espouses proletarian revolution, but also with Jean-Luc Mélenchon's La France Insoumise, or France Unbowed, which our listener describes as a violent, deranged, far-left Antifa group that the communists even privately regard as infantile leftists who should be shot in accordance with the praxis of comrades Lenin and Stalin, and which many, perhaps all of the socialist members of the coalition regard with good reason as lunatics and criminals who should be in prison or psychiatric hospitals. So this is this leftist coalition that the centrist Emmanuel Macron, the current president's party, ended up into this electoral alliance with. He goes on to say, good news. The rioting in Paris and other big cities to celebrate the victory of the left has been highly instructive for the French bourgeoisie. Anyone who believed that it would be prudent to vote against the national rally to prevent riots has just learned that a large section of the left bloc supporters will smash and destroy just for the hell of it, win or lose, and that voting against the national rally has no prophylactic effect upon urban youths. Everyone was expecting if the national rally, the identitarians actually got a majority or came in first, the place would go up in flames. And that's why all these police were out. Well, the lefties win and the place goes up in flames anyway. So there you go. Arguably, our listener writes in to say, the fact that they won, that emboldens them, and it's more free back-to-school shopping. Now, Mr. Mélenchon, he is this hard left, hard-boiled lefty bomb-throwing types, giving his first reaction, called on the French Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, to resign, and said the left-wing coalition is ready to govern. On the other hand, Macron probably has it in mind to persuade the Socialist Party and the Greens to double-cross Mélenchon and join his new government, so-called, led by Macron's Prime Minister Gabriel Attal. He's the current Prime Minister. He's going to say, okay, he's going to try to split the lefty coalition, hive off the guys who are really repulsive, get the Social Democrats and maybe gather a few people from his party and maybe carve off a few other conservatives here and there to join a sort of a coalition government of the center. The socialists, their perfectly reasonable hatred and contempt for Mélenchon's La France Insoumise, the France Unbowed bomb throwers, might make that seem a tempting offer. However, the hatred and contempt that the French people feel for Macron himself makes supporting him a one-way ticket to electoral oblivion, so the Socialist Party and the Greens will think twice about taking up that offer. So the point is, and I've probably jabbered on more than this particular election deserves, but as I say, I lived in France and I pay attention to France and I find what's going on there absolutely fascinating. I think it's entirely possible that France will not have a proper prime minister and a government, a coalition government of any kind. It could be weeks, it could be months. But this sometimes happens. You know, the Belgians got into that state. Italians sometimes find themselves in that state. You got 7 or 8 different parties. Nobody's got a solid majority. They all got to trade horses and then trade mules and then trade donkeys and trade sheep. Finally get down to, I don't know, trading mice to try to figure out how to make something work. And the French are not good at that. So it'll be exciting. It will be very exciting. And then they've got the Olympics coming on, 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
Now, let me ask you a couple questions.
Yes, please.
So in 2012, the national rally, I believe it was not named that at that point. I don't remember when they went through the rebranding. Forgive me.
Yes, that was when I can't remember the year either, but that's when they kicked Jean-Marie Le Pen out of the party because he was considered too much of a hard-boiled guy.
Persona non grata. But
yeah, his own daughter kicks him out of the party. But
yeah, Ryan Gruduski had a great tweet. Great tweet yes. today. It said, national rally seats in the French parliament over the last 12 years, 2012, 2.
Yep.
2017, 8. 2022, 89. 2024, 140 to 150 seats. Now, I can remember back in 2002, maybe it was 2004, 2005, there were some really, I think it was 2005, there were some really bad riots in Paris. Some very bad riots. And, you know, the Le Pen's party, again, if they were sniffing one or two seats, it was international news. Same thing with the British National Party under Nick Griffin. You know, I think he maybe had a seat for a cup of coffee. Maybe they had a couple of other individuals elected. That was international news. And here we are, guys, ladies and gentlemen around the world listening to this podcast. As Gruduski points out, you go from 2 seats in 2012
to 140 to 150 seats in 2024.
The actual figure is 143, by the way.
When he sent the tweet out, Mr. Taylor, he didn't.
Yes, it wasn't certain.
End result was going to be. But I think that is such extraordinary, exponential, amazing growth. I've got to go
no
back.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that Guillaume Fay's last book he dedicated to you, correct?
No, he didn't dedicate any books to me, but he has mentioned me kindly frequently. Yeah. I wrote a foreword to one of his books.
You wrote a foreword to one of his books. Yes. I believe the coming. I just think there's so many exciting things happening, and the French, we're now seeing that moment where it's becoming obvious that there are enough French who want to survive. And
well, you know, when push came to shove, if there were enough French who wanted to survive, then they could have at least put the National Rally in first place. As it turns out, the leftist coalition came in first in number of seats in the Chamber of Deputies. Then comes Macron's centralist Central Alliance, because they both played off each other. They both were in this alliance to get, I'll give you this seat and you give me that seat. It's this crooked deal. And they both came out better for it, but still the National Rally came in third rather than first. First would have been absolutely wonderful, but there's no question about it. This progression over the years reflects a growing French realization that the way things are going is no damn good. On the other hand, as Marine Le Pen has softened her program, tried to make it all sound very gentle, no, there'll be no remigration, you know, we're just going to stop the inward flows, we love our little Moroccan brothers and sisters. This has not made it possible for her to make the National Rally be considered a regular party like everybody else. It's still the case that all the other parties get together and say, we have to preserve Republican values and keep these swine out. But you are 100% correct. Even in the face of that, to have had 143 seats from these very, very modest beginnings is a remarkable achievement. And this is not going to be a sprint. This is going to be a marathon to get our countries back. No question about it.
Victory or death.
Yes, yes. Venceremos, as patria o muerte, the fatherland or death. Venceremos, we will win. That was Fidel Castro's slogan. So, you know, you can't give the lefties to have all the good slogans. So, let us see. Okay, having jabbered all that much about France, let us move back to the United States. And you have two stories, one set in Birmingham and another set in a place called Ocala, which was new to me. But do tell, what's happening amongst our dusky brethren?
Let's preface this by pointing out that in Steve Saylor's interview with Tucker Carlson, he favorably mentioned you for not being welcome back to Twitter. And Tucker Carlson brought up this great point. No one really talks about the cities that were so important in the civil rights epoch. Birmingham, Alabama, of course, is one of the most important. You can go to Kelly Ingram Park. I have a lot of family from Birmingham. They've all left, obviously. They went over the mountain where it was rebuilt in Hoover, Vestavia, and Mountain Brook and Spain Park. But I love Birmingham. And I think the whole 2020, what made that so depressing was the Confederate monument in Birmingham was not saved. It was an obelisk. It was beautiful. I've seen it. I have pictures of me in front of it. And that was taken down, Mr. Taylor. And it's
remarkable what's still left. What's still left?
There's still an awful lot left, and there's still a lot that will go back up. And
a statue of Jeff Davis right there on the grounds, and where he took the oath of office, there is that, I guess that's that brass plaque right in the top step of the Capitol steps. There's still a few remnants of the Confederacy.
Well, that's in Montgomery, right?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Montgomery. Yes, you're absolutely right. That's the capital. I know. I beg your pardon. Montgomery. Yeah. Yes.
So this story, a number of people actually sent this to me, and I can't thank you guys enough, ladies and gentlemen, who send us stories. Because, again, there's so many things happening out there. It's hard to keep track of all these wonderful little anecdotes that are popping up in you know, cities across the country. So, again, for those listening, you can get in touch with me very easily at becausewelivehere@protonmail.com. Once again, that email address, because we live here at protonmail.com, or you can contact Mr. Taylor and his fantastic team at the New Century Foundation by... Oh, did I lose you?
No. You go to amren.com, A-M-R-E-N.com, and you click on the Contact Us tab, and your message will come straight to me.
Excellent. But, well, so the story we're talking about, one of the recurring themes of this podcast is you and I's mutual love of ShotSpotter. Now, I know they've changed their name, of course. We've talked about, of course, Chicago trying to get rid of it. Well, Birmingham apparently is a client. And this story was from Alabama.com, AL.com. Headline is 2,164 gunshots were fired in one Birmingham neighborhood in 1 year. Unacceptable, Mayor Woodfin has said. Now, this is in the East Lake neighborhood of Birmingham, Alabama. It's not that many residents. I want to say it's only a couple thousand. It's an 80% black neighborhood in a city that's about 72% black. And like I said, as Steve Saylor said, nobody talks about what Birmingham looks like in 2024. Well, here's what it looks like. ShotSpotter detected 2,164 shots fired during 2023 in the East Lake neighborhood, Mayor Randall Woodfin told the Birmingham City Council on Tuesday. And that's unacceptable. The most glaring problem in this neighborhood is shooting into occupied dwellings where people have over 40 ways to easily drive into this historic neighborhood, shoot at a house, and drive out. The time we respond, person's long gone, but we know they're shooting because of our shot spotter. That 2,164 shots detected is an average of about 6 shots fired per day. Many of these shots fired into the houses or cars by shooters driving through the neighborhood. That's just in the East Lake neighborhood, not the entire East Lake community that includes Southeast Lake, Northeast Lake, and Wahoma, Woodfin said. It's part of a litany of crime issues in East Lake that have been out of control. Woodfin said the city's been cracking down on illegal dumping on Division Avenue, prostitution on First Avenue North, drug dealing and speeding on Second Avenue North. This sounds like Wakanda, Mr. Taylor. Woodfin recently announced the Safe Streets Initiative, a pilot plan to shut down the street access to limit drivers coming into the East Lake neighborhood to shoot at houses and cars.
Well now, hold on. He's going to limit... motor car access to the neighborhood because people just drive in and blaze away at occupied houses? This is just sport?
This sounds like something that even Mel Gibson and I can't remember the guy who directed, I think his name was not Maxwell. I think it may have been Waxwell, the guy who directed the Mad Max films that have come out and that are so over the top in what a post-apocalyptic world will look like when in fact, if ShotSpotter is detecting, on average, 6 shots per day in this one little neighborhood, which only has a couple thousand residents.
Well, see, ordinarily you think of people shooting at somebody in particular. But this sounds like people just drive around and say, oh, there's a nice looking house. I think I'll put its window out. Kabam, bam.
It's definitely not... definitely not George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life trying to throw rocks through the window of the old abandoned home that Mary wants to move to eventually.
Nope.
This is a neighborhood that everyone's trying to avoid. Here he goes. He says that we will continue our aggressive policing. We'll continue to focus on gun violence citywide. Now, I should preface this by saying, Mr. Taylor, Birmingham has been afflicted with some unbelievably heinous rates of violent crime this year. You know, everyone's saying that, you know, crime is dropping, not in Birmingham. And I think that if we looked at a lot of cities in the South, if we looked at a lot of cities across the country, we'd see the same thing, that it's even reaching levels maybe beyond what we saw from that jump from 2019 to 2020 to 2021 when we saw the depolicing going on. I believe we can decrease gun violence in this neighborhood, Winfin said. Yeah, of course you could if you remove the population that's there and you had white people come back from over the mountain and reclaim the city. Anyways, City Council member J.T. Moore, whose district includes Eastlake, said that abandoned properties in the neighborhood contribute to crime. He said the city needs to encourage people to move back into the neighborhood. Yes, if there are that many gunshots per day, good luck on that.
I think abandoned properties discourage crime. The fewer people, the fewer, less crime you're going to have, it seems to me. Of course, it does give the neighborhood a certain spooky, abandoned and outside the law feel to it. But
anyway. Yeah, yeah. Well, he would go on to say this, quote, "We lost the neighbors out of our neighborhood, so we're just left with the hood."
That's good.
That is very good. That is very good. Division Avenue alleys are among the worst for illegal dumping, Woodfin said. In April, we saw illegal dumping. We would clean it up. It would be back on the ground within 72 hours. In May, we'd clean it up again. Pick it up. It's back on the ground. June, back on the ground. Clean it up. It's back. Just yesterday, 7 trucks were hauled off of illegal dumping. That's just on Division. Prostitution also was rampant in East Lake, he said. You see daywalkers, streetwalkers, prostitution. Pretty unapologetic about it. Unabashed about it. Broad daylight, Woodfin said. We've had stings. We've had undercovers. We've arrested Johns. We've arrested prostitutes. And the activity continues. Well, I think one of the most important things you can do is just look at what's happened in El Salvador with Bukele, and you have to arrest everyone. I think the most important thing is we're reaching a point in the United States and a lot of these cities where black mayors of formerly thriving metropolises are realizing that if they're going to have any sense of tax base left, you've got to start arresting the bad guys. Use RICO laws if you have to, because if not, you're going to have a mayor like in Chicago, where I think you just had 100 people shot over July 4th in Chicago.
Right. That's right. We'll get to that. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a teaser. But that's, I mean, all right. Yeah. that mayor does everything he can to try and claim that, oh, Chicago is the blackest city in the country. It's so important to the black community and black folk. And it's like, all right, do we really want to talk about what the black contributions to Chicago are? I just feel like we're at this point where, you know, the restoration of law and order is so close.
Well, you know, I think that in some of these black-run cities, they're going to realize that all of this namby-pamby leftist coddling of criminals is for the birds. It does not work. It doesn't work for white people. It doesn't work for black people. And I think what you need is the equivalent of the fruit of Islam. Remember the fruit of Islam? Don't hear about them too much.
No.
But those are the bully boys of the Nation of Islam. They walk around in their snappy suits and their bow ties, and they maintain law and order. They take no guff. Turn the fruit of Islam loose on some of these neighborhoods, and I think they could whip them into shape. But the trouble is, you're going to get all of our crazy leftist, the SPLC would probably try to litigate to stop that stuff. The American Civil Liberties Union, but they really do need to just clamp down. That's the only solution for a lot of these black-run towns and these black shoot-em-ups.
I've told people this before, that individuals like you and I are the best friend of the black community, because we're trying to keep people alive. And our knowledge of who's committing the crime, again, it's not like there are white people putting on a black mask and going out and shooting people just for their racial delight. It's black.
No, it's black psychopaths shooting down people, and this idea of just going to a neighborhood and shooting into occupied buildings just for the heck of it, happening in Birmingham. I mean, if I understand your story correctly, that's what they're doing. Just joyriding and joy shooting. If somebody gets killed, I guess that's just extra points.
Well, remember the story we talked about? We talked about the story, I want to say probably back in March, out of somewhere in Mississippi. Was it, Biloxi, where there was a military base that they had to put up that huge fence or that huge wall because so many were shooting into the military base. Yeah. I believe it's from the Navy Seabees, where the Navy Seabees were trained. It's a very important military base. And yet, to keep the members of the Navy Seabees safe and their families, they had to construct this massive wall. And it's...
Yep. Just being anywhere near the neighborhood is risky to your life.
Yeah.
And
why I chose that story, Mr. Taylor, I love to be able to explain this stuff to people. White flight existed for a reason. And this story is emblematic of why, you know, everything that we've had to endure over the past 60, 70 years. This was a very nice neighborhood at one point. There are some really nice homes in these forsaken cities, and there's a reason they're forsaken. There's a reason they're abandoned. There's a reason why that city council member called it the hood. And it's in the absence of whiteness, blackness is allowed to prevail.
Well, that really is the tragedy of this. I remember a friend of mine took me through some of the old neighborhoods in Memphis. Memphis is practically uninhabitable now because of the crime white people are clearing out. But there are these lingering, dwindling enclaves of just the most gracious, beautiful homes. Some of them have now been taken over. They're full of people who could never maintain them, could never have had them built. And of course, that's a story in Detroit too. If you go into these blasted neighborhoods, many of them, even in ruins, you see beautiful architecture, wonderful, wonderful neighborhoods that white people built with love, and they lived there happily. They cherished these places. They switched race, and they have just been completely shot. That is one of the great horrors of the fact that blacks take places over. The housing stock just goes completely in ruin, no matter how beautiful, how gorgeous, how architecturally significant it was. It's just heartbreaking to see that happen.
No comment, because there's no comment that can be made. It's, again, there's very simple ways to make things better for everyone. And right now we can't do that because we can't be honest about who's making things worse for everyone, and particularly the black community. It's black individuals preying upon the black community. And here's another story for that. When is enough enough? Ocala leaders call for an end to black gun violence in black community. That's the question Pastor Daryl Tolbert, a longtime member of War Cry for Peace, asked the people who gathered Wednesday at a candlelight vigil for 24-year-old Derek DJ Brown. I don't know if he was an aspiring rapper, but if he was, he's yet another individual who's added to the expiring rapper list that we regrettably have to keep as a tally. Tolbert said he has lost count on how many of these events he has attended and how many speeches he has made about the loss of yet another young life. Brown's death is one of many shooting deaths throughout the years in Marion County. The victims often are black men and women. Now, I didn't get a chance to look this up. I believe Marion County is where Tallahassee is. I think Ocala, I think that's Florida. I'll confirm.
It sure sounds like Florida.
Yeah, it sounds like Ocala sounds like one of those Indian tribes that's associated with the Seminoles. No arrest has been made in this case, and police have not released any theories about a possible motive. All right, police. Tolbert approaches these tragedies with sadness, but also resolve. As a younger man, he sold drugs and usually was armed. He told the audience he understands what it's like because he was once in the game. It sounds like a game that no one wins. But he said he later asked himself when he was going to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. Being in the game, he said, always ends one of two ways, prison or the graveyard. For him, it was prison. Once he was released, he turned his life around and hasn't looked back. Now he tries to comfort those who have suffered losses. It talks about where Brown was shot. And then it goes into a little bit more about just how awful it was. About how the individual who did the shooting, again, another person who was shot in the area was black as well. No arrest has been made in her case either, and no details about a possible motive released. And again, that just gets to the point that in these areas, as we've talked about, in any city, it doesn't matter where it is, if it's majority black, you have no snitching. You have a paucity of black individuals who are interested in cooperating with police. And that's why the clearance rate for non-fatal shootings and homicides is just so dramatically low. I saw, Mr. Taylor, that on your on the Ameren website, you posted the breakdown of the Milwaukee Homicide Commission for 2023. And I put that together. And it's astonishing to look at how it's less than 2% of the gun crime, because it's only, of course, those who have been arrested. The clearance rate's terrible for non-fatal and homicide, non-fatal shootings and homicides. But in a city that's about 38% white, white people make up less than 2% of the suspects in fatal and non-fatal shootings.
Yes, it's not all that difficult to do the calculations. And if you figure out if the population were entirely white, and committed these crimes at the rate in which the current population does it, you would have a reduction by about maybe 90, 95% of these crimes. You really could defund the police if the population were all white and the new people were committing crimes at the rate white people do. By the way, Ocala is in right smack, east-west terms, right in the middle of Florida, right at the level of about Daytona Beach. It's not really all that close to anything in particular. Gainesville is to its north. Orlando's a good way to the south. But in any case, yes, it is in Florida. And it, you know, all of these people that claim to care about black lives, the white people, and even the black people claim to care about black lives, they certainly don't seem to. I mean, we may speak flippantly about black behavior, and we may contrast it very negatively to white behavior, but you're right. I think we care more about all of these homicide victims than the people who claim to speak for them, certainly. What is that lawyer Crump? What is he really doing for black people? What is Jesse Jackson really doing for black people? All they're doing is shaking down white people so that their friends can get rich. That's all the good that those people do in terms of really trying to make life better for these people who live in these terrible neighborhoods where people just drive by and shoot in the building, a neighborhood with how many thousand gunshots in a single year? This is intolerable. These are not the kinds of lives that people should be living in the United States of America, no matter what race you are.
Yeah, 2,164. It's an average of six per day. And by the way, just to confirm, the East Lake community, it's 2,794. Mr. Taylor, there are almost more gunshots than there is a population. Think about that for a second.
Well, I guess if everybody went out and fired off around every day, this is just nuts. Well, let us move to something else that's nuts, and this is the status of free speech in the Federal Republic of Germany. A politician for the Alternative for Germany, my favorite German party, was convicted for the second time for knowingly using a Nazi slogan.
Oh,
this is Bjorn Hock. I don't know how you pronounce his name. Hocke. Hocke, Hock. I wish my German were a little bit better. I wish it were a lot better. He plans to run for governor for the eastern state of Thuringia in September. He was fined for using the banned Nazi slogan. Get this, everybody. This is awfully scary talk. The slogan is "Everything for Germany." Can't say that. That's a banned Nazi slogan. The Halle Regional Court found the 52-year-old guilty of using signs of unconstitutional and terrorist organizations. I guess Nazism was unconstitutional and terrorist. Sentenced him to a fine of 130 euros a day for a period that adds up to 16,900 euros. I guess you can pay on the installment plan if you got fined for that. An appeal is possible. Now, the conviction, on the other hand, will not block him for running for governor of Thuringia. The interesting thing here is Hocke was already fined 13,000 euros in May for using symbols of an unconstitutional organization, and this is also being appealed. That is the result of a speech he gave at Meersburg, in which he used the phrase, once again, "everything for Germany." Well, now, his latest sin, Mr. Kersey, and this just goes to show you that Mr. Hocke has a sense of humor. He was addressing an enthusiastic audience, and he said, "everything for?" And it was the audience that supplied the missing words. Everything, he didn't even say "everything for Germany." He simply said "everything for," and his audience supplied the missing word. Well, there you go. That's the kind of fun they have in Germany. And so he's fined yet again for using, when you can be fined for saying "everything for Germany," because apparently that was something that stormtroopers once upon a time said. Now, there haven't been any stormtroopers since 1945. That's a long time ago. Isn't that about 75 years now? In any case, everything for Germany can get you fined in Germany. You can say everything for Germany here, fortunately. You can even say make America great again without being fined, but that day may come also. Now, sticking in the Europe side of things, Viktor Orban's Nationalist Patriots for Europe group, that's in the Euro Parliament, has been officially established, and it boasts 84 MEPs, members of the European Parliament, making it the third largest group. Now, the fact of having a parliamentary group in the European Parliament is very, very important because they can hold inquiries, they can commission studies, they can propose laws. You have to have an official group. And this newly formed, they call it a far-right alliance, launched just last week and has succeeded the previous alliance known as Identity and Democracy, which has now been disbanded. And this group, again, it's called Patriots for Europe. I like that. It has swiftly expanded, with many parties announcing last week that they would join. The French RN, Marine Le Pen's party, which is the center of this ruckus in France right now. Italy's Lega party, and two key former Identity and Democracy parties, they have joined the group. Now, Lega was dominant within Identity and Democracy, and also they are followed by Orban's Fidesz party with 11 and Matteo Salvini's Lega with 8. And other nationalist delegations include Austria's Freedom Party. These will be familiar names for those of our listeners who are following European politics. Spain's Vox Party, the Dutch Nationalist PVV, and also, this is a group with which I was unfamiliar, a group called ANO. That is a Czech group. That's called ANO stands for Action of Dissatisfied Citizens. Now, that would be a good name for a party in this country or just about any Western country. And the head of that party is the current prime minister of Czechia. So there you go. The ruling party is a member of this patriot group. Also, there are lawmakers from Belgium's Vlaams Belang, Portugal's Chega. Chega is C-H-E-G-A with an exclamation mark. And then, Mr. Kersey, here's another apparently identitarian party with which I was unfamiliar. It's Chechia's Oath and Motorists Party. Now, I would love to know what Oath and Motorists are all about. Maybe I'll look that up and I will regale our listeners with what the Oath and Motorists Party is all about. Then there's two from Greece's Voice of Reason, the Latvia First Party, and one from the Danish People's Party. So this is really great news. They have got a very, very substantial showing in the European Parliament, third largest group, and let us hope they get a lot of things done.
Mr. Taylor, just to go back and just to reiterate how important this all is. I mean, this is heard of 2 decades ago. This is unheard of when you have Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is scaring the New York Times with maybe one or two people being elected. When Nick Griffin and the British National Party were, you know, barely making any noise, it was a seismic shift. And now you basically just saw, you know, the Tories routed, you know, in England. And who cares? They were awful. They ruled 15 years. They should have been completely routed. You know, there's so much to love of the story you just told and the story earlier of what happened in France. Again, the most important thing to understand is the current world order is doing everything they can to stop implicit whiteness from becoming explicit, which is why the title of your most important book, sir, is White Identity. It's nothing,
well, thank you.
It's nothing over the top. It's simply a concept that has to be defeated at every turn by every institution, be it private or public. And
meanwhile, Donald Trump is courting black men.
Yeah, this is a weird story, and I'm going to try and read through it because it's more of a editorial. But Trump is courting black men as he pledges return to a policy that disproportionately targets them. But again, it makes safer communities where blacks proliferate without, you know, as there are fewer and fewer whites. You know, for years, lawyers and advocates have fought the use of stop and frisk. We've talked about this for a long time in places like Philadelphia and New York. You know, William Bratton wrote a great book about how broken windows policing and stop and frisk made New York City safer. He was brought to all sorts of cities to be the police commissioner as well, where they implemented stop and frisk. Unfortunately, as the author of this piece says, it's a police tactic that left a majority of black and brown men who experienced it physically and mentally scarred and distrustful of law enforcement. Get over that. After a lengthy legal battle, a federal judge in 2013 found it unconstitutional, essentially banning it. Still, former President Trump wants to bring it back. A key pillar of his anti-crime platform demands police departments reinstate stop and frisk, which allows officers to randomly stop and search people for weapons or else risk critical federal dollars flow into their coffers. Quote, I will insist that local jurisdictions return to proven common sense policing measures such as stop and frisk, he said on his campaign website. It's very simple. And I love that. You should be able to cut the coffers off to cities that refuse to do this, because again, you're gonna save a lot of dollars if you're doing stop and frisk and not have so many of these individuals show up at the emergency rooms and the ERs where they have to be patched up. And then if you and I have talked about many times from these journals we read, just the unbelievable cost that a gunshot victim falls upon the city to have to take care of. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's insanity.
Yes, that's crazy.
Not for many black men who are perplexed that Trump would claim to covet their vote, but wants policy that has proven to target and hurt black men. Travis Hunter, an author, is one. His first visit to New York about 20 years ago was supposed to be a joyful experience. He had just signed a major book deal, but within seconds of having left his hotel for a celebratory dinner, he said three white police officers jumped out of an unmarked car demanding he press his palms against a wall and spread his legs. When Hunter asked why, he said an officer spat, "Shut up," inward. Yeah, that never happened. "Where are you coming from?" an officer demanded. "Where are you going?" An officer pulled out Hunter's wallet from his back pocket and studied his Georgia driver's license. "He tossed the wallet back at me and then went back to the car and drove off," Hunter recalled. He was left standing on the street, stunned, furious, and so violated he could not even stand to report the incident to authorities.
Well, I wonder if this really happened. After that. Frankly, I bet a lot of black people just make that stuff up, or they make up the details. Maybe he did get stopped, but I bet he was not called the N-word.
I doubt he was called the N-word, yes.
No. This is just three white cops? Come on.
I just don't believe it. He was not called a ne'er-do-well. We know that. Come on. It's, it didn't happen. And again, I bet you that he told the story to try and drum up publicity for his book.
Of course. He's
probably getting ready to go into the Today Show. One of the things we're seeing is Trump's appeals have at times been effective. He's gained the support of black entertainers like Yee and Sexy Red. I think Yee, that's Kanye West. I'm not up to date on my black rapper notoriety, but I'll guess that's who it is. And other times not, like saying black voters relate to him because of his mugshot, which I think is actually pretty funny. With stop and frisk, Trump appears to be catering to his supporters who want him to be tough on crime in urban areas, despite lows in the national crime rate, which, of course, again, there's a link to in the story. I doubt that's even true. Hoping the message also appeals to black voters who were unenthused about Biden and who are more likely to support his economic policies. But with 2 million black men having experienced stop and frisk, even some black conservatives who support Trump, like Shelley Winter, a New Yorker who lives in Atlanta, say they're ambivalent about the policy. Stop and frisk, in theory, is not a bad plan. I'm not opposed to it. Its activation becomes problematic. The co-host of Word on the Street with Malachi Massey on WSBFM in Atlanta, that's a radio station. In addition to its unconstitutionality, he said, the other problem is in its implementation, because what do? Is you give carte blanche for the police to just do whatever they want, and you live in a constant state of police. I mean, again, do you want to live in a constant state of police, or do you want to live in a place like Eastlake, Birmingham, Alabama, where there are almost as many shootings per year as there are citizens, and where they're basically having to shut down access to this hood because there are so many shootings? I think this is such a interesting correlation between the two, because it's so simple if you actually use police power to stop black gun crime.
You might be better off also if you assign only blacks to those neighborhoods to do stop and frisk. That way they can't claim it's a white racist cop that stopped you and frisked you. Now, This story of yours reminds me of my latest video that had to do with some of the utterly cuckoo goofy things that blacks say. You are probably aware of this story. Pew Research did a survey of blacks and asked them what they thought about this, that, and the other. And the results were so hair-raising that Pew titled the report of its study, Blacks Believe in Racial Conspiracy Theories. Well, the lefties all said, oh, that's horrible, that's horrible. That suggests that blacks are irrational in what they think. And so they finally changed the title of the thing. And it says, blacks believe that institutions were founded to establish to hold them back or something like that. Well, I urge all of our listeners to go watch that video or read the script, which appears on the AMRAN page. But one of the things that 74% of black people believe, Mr. Kersey, is that, and I'm sorry, it's 76%. 76%.
Oh, 2% more. Okay.
Yes. That the police do very little to stop guns and drugs from flooding black communities. Well, let's think about that. How are guns and drugs flooding black communities? I mean, do they think that the Ku Klux Klan loads up trucks full of cocaine and Glocks and just dumps them on the street corners in the ghetto and these otherwise law-abiding, church-going black people stumble across them and get high and shoot each other and wouldn't have otherwise? I mean, guns and drugs are flooding black communities. I mean, of course, guns and drugs end up there because blacks want them. There's a huge demand for them, and that's why they're there. But there's this flood, this sort of natural tsunami, I suppose, and the police do very little to stop it. Well, Mr. Kersey, what is one of the things to keep guns out of the hands of the bad guys? It's known as stop and frisk. Mm-hmm. And it worked pretty well in New York City. Do you remember, his name is escaped, Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg. He was a great advocate of stop and frisk. Of course, the ACLU got involved, and that's probably in connection with that suit that a judge said it was unconstitutional, as if it could be unconstitutional. I guess they said it was some sort of illegal search and seizure. But in any case, the statistics on stop and frisk, it reminds you of Bukele. If you stop enough skeevy-looking guys, you're going to find a lot of guns and a lot of drugs. And if you take that stuff off the street, there's going to be less mayhem and less killing. In any case, I think black people are capable of believing completely idiotic and contrary things. There's somehow this title, maybe it's the FBI who is funneling all of those guns and drugs into the black community. What do you think? They think there's some flood and the police aren't doing enough to stop it. Well, if they try to stop it, then, oh, that's over-policing. That's over-policing. That's racial profiling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, while I'm talking about it, I suppose I should point out some of the other things that blacks think were designed to hold people back. Designed. The prison system, it was set up to hold people back. Well, as I pointed out in my video, the first prison was established in Boston in 1635 at a time when there wasn't a single black person living in the entire city of Boston. Not one. Oh, those evil black people. They were getting ready to lock up innocent blacks before they'd even clapped eyes on one. Oh, they're so bad, bad, bad. And then, did you know that 65% of blacks believe that the economic system was designed to hold them down? The economic system. Who designed the economic system, Mr. Kersey? I don't think you can't just really describe it as having been designed by anybody in particular, but whoever designed it, oh boy, was looking over his shoulder the whole time. How are we going to hold these black people down? They believe amazing things. And another thing that they believe, 74% of blacks believe that, here we go. That black people are disproportionately incarcerated so prisons can make money. Mm. Did you know that? Prisons can make money. Prisons are just an economic boom for the community.
No, I don't think that's true, but...
I don't think that's true, but 74% of black people believe that. Well, let's see. Do we have any short stories left that won't take too long? Because we are... Oh, yes. I have a Joe Biden story for you.
Joe Biden.
Yes, Joe Biden. Now, I am the only guy in America who thinks that Joe Biden did a good job in the debate. I think he stuck to the facts. He answered questions. He made some charges against Donald Trump that Trump was unable to reply effectively to. I thought he improved his chances with his debate, but I'm the only person in America who thinks that. I admit it.
Okay.
But during an interview with a Philadelphia radio station, he said these words. By the way, I'm proud to be, as I said, the first vice president, first black woman to serve with a black president. Proud to be involved of the first black woman on the Supreme Court. There's so much that we can do because, look, we're the United States of America. I thought that was a stellar quote. By the way, I'm proud to be, as I said, the first vice president, first black woman to serve for the black president. I guess he's confused like so many Democrats as to whether he's a boy or a girl. And have you noticed that he'd love to say, by the way, I think during that debate, he said, by the way, 50 times. Well, Mr. Kersey, our time has come. Our cup runneth over with stories, but our cup of time runneth under. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure and a joy and an honor to spend this time with you. And we are grateful. We are thrilled to do this. And we look forward to spending this time with you again next week. Thank you so much.